Brown University, whose imaginative visualizations of whatever's going on in his head are always worth a peek.
Okay, well, it's great to be here. I was a student of Bill's at Princeton from 1987 to 1991. And Bill always liked to play on the computer. Whenever I'd go into his office and talk to him, he would be like this, and then he'd get a question, and then he'd going, and then he'd look again, and it went like that. He also really delighted in simple things. That somehow I always took that as an inspiration, that he would seem to like to do the first things of everything. And I remember, for instance, he just plotted the sine function and then just plotted all the Taylor series approximations, all the polynomials, and it had this kind of beautiful picture. It looked a lot like a foliation. It had that kind of up on the bulletin board. There were lots of kind of simple things like that which I really liked. So I'm going to show you a bunch of, this isn't really a research talk, but I'm just going to show you a bunch of programs that I wrote, starting with really simple ones and eventually getting to ones that are more complicated. All the ones that I'm going to show you are written in Java. I think all but one I wrote myself, although one of them Pat Hooper and I wrote. Actually, a lot of them is sort of the miracle of reuse. They all sort of look the same, and it just comes from So let's see. So just start out with some simple ones. Okay, so here's the
Pythagorean theorem demo. So it's a squared equals b squared plus c squared. For a while, I was learning to make applets, and this somehow took me 42 to get to this point. Okay, so
that's pretty self-explanatory. Okay. Yeah, so this one's the Euclidean algorithm.
You take a square, in this case 89 by 55, and the algorithm is you cut out a square. So this is the, and if you count the squares and you group them the right way, you get the continued fraction.
So you can click and
so to see how the continued fraction expansion, this would be 96 over 60.
Okay. That's what that one does. The first few are kind of simple like that. Let's see. Yeah, this one's the Poncelet porism. What's that?
Can you enlarge the pictures?
No. Not on this one. So this one, if you don't know what the Poncelet porism is, you start at a point on the outer circle and you draw a tangent line to the ellipse and then continue to get to the next point on the circle, you can continue this process. And if you happen to close up like you do here after 23 times, then the theorem is that no matter which point you start with, it also closes up. So that's why you see this continuous motion of things. And you can specify the shape, and it sort of does, yeah, it does some kind of relaxation algorithm to refine the, anyway, okay, so, all right, that's that. This one is a good one to show kids, I guess. It's not geometrical, but you can do Pascal's triangle mod 2, for example. So this is like the first row of Pascal's triangle is like 0, 1, 0, and then 0, 1, 1, 0. And so if you haven't seen this, it's a good advertisement for math. You're coloring the even ones blue and the odd ones white. So this is what you see if you do Pascal's triangle mod 2. it's kind of, I'm sure this is well understood, although you could also do it, you know, mod 3 or something, or mod 5. You can do it mod 4. It's a little bit harder to explain or understand, but I think if you color it like that, you can sort of see. If you do it mod 6, it's really hard to understand. I think it's some kind of superposition of mod 2 and mod 3. Anyway, so this is a anyway, this is a good one to get people interested in. What's that? Oh, this is just showing the central limit theorem, or the law of large numbers, that when you, if you just scale the numbers in Pascal's triangle the right way, it converges to the Gaussian. So, yeah, I mean, Java has a canvas. It lets you, you know, it's just some specific, you know, class in Java, and it lets you draw squares and, line segments and so on. And, you know, so there's some math part of the program. So in this case, there's just some big array of, you know, some big array of squares, or, you know, diagonal array of squares, and then the thing just, you know, computes Pascal's triangle mod whatever you like, and then it just, you know, it kind of sends the information to this canvas, and it just, you know, has instructions to compute it. I mean, the main thing, I suppose, it's different from this than just a program that just spits out, you know, numbers, is just that this canvas kind of can interpret the data, and, you know, you can just get it to plot things. I mean, but, you know, the real answer is somehow reuse. I mean, I made simple ones first, and then it, you know, I guess you can make it look better, get rid of the edges. Okay, so that's it's another one. They're going to get more complicated as it goes. So this is a game I made called Lucy and Lily. The way it works is that you
click a pentagon around. This one is related to something that Bill really likes, which is I'll say in a minute what it is.
So what you can do is you move the pentagon away from the
central
target, and then by flipping it, and then the goal is to move it back. And you can kind of randomly move it away like that. Maybe I'll play on the left. So, oops. So I need a volunteer. Does anyone? Anyone? Okay, Rick. Okay, so.
Am I Lucy or Lily?
So you just have to move the thing back.
Are you a full charge?
What?
We're worried that the volunteer actually knows that work with you in the past.
That's true.
He might. Maybe he's smart enough to do it.
Can you show me?
No. No, just. Okay, you did it. All right. Okay, but it's supposed to be. All right. Yeah, that was too easy.
So, could you explain this game one more time?
Sure. So the way it works is that you have a pentagon, and you can flip it over any of its edges. And then the goal is just simply to put it back to its target. All right, so who wants to try again?
Do the five-colored triangles have a function, or are they just for color?
Well, they're for color. Okay, so I want to show you something. The game, I didn't explain the whole game.
You should say that the lattice is dense. I mean, so...
Yeah, so one thing to say is that the set of positions that this thing can occupy is it's a dense set in the plane. So even though Rick got lucky, I wanted a volunteer just to indicate that it was hard, but he managed to do it. But The thing I wanted to show you, so it's very, if you just do one on your own, if you just play it, it's hard to get it back. But I want to show you, what the interesting thing is that you can play two games at the same time, and they're linked, so that if I click on the red of one, it clicks on the red of the other. And if I click on the yellow of the one, it clicks on the yellow of the other. So now what you can do is you can play greedily, and you can move first that one over like that, and then that one over like that, and then it solves it. So maybe I'll do it again. So this one's probably pretty hard to do on its own. You can't really see what to do next. But if you do them both.
I'm lost again here. What is there, some sort of simultaneous goal you're trying to achieve here?
That's right. The two pentagons are linked. And whenever you move one, the other one moves, and vice versa. And then there's a simultaneous goal of getting them both exactly back to where they are. And what I'm saying is that if you play with just one of them, it's hard to do. Okay, so right. So if you look closely at it, the coloring is such that the colors on one are adjacent, if and only if the colors on the other are not adjacent. Or another way to say it is, if I go around once on the left, it goes around twice on the right. So, or another way to say it is, if I am at the point Z, so to speak, if think of 0 as the center and I reflect to get to the point Z in one, I reflect to get to the point Z squared in the other. Another way to say it is, if you look at the set of positions, it's always going to be in some ring. It's essentially Z adjoined the fifth root of unity. And if you look at the position of one versus the position of the other, they're Galois conjugates. So this is the thing that Bill liked a lot, to take this Galois embedding. So if you think of the positions of both of them at the same time, it's really a point in R4. And what you're really doing is you're embedding a point X, and it's the Galois conjugate of X at the same time. So as you're playing this thing at the same time, now I can explain the secret of this. One thing about the coloring is that if one of them moves fast, the other one moves slow. Because if you want to move the one of them fast, you're clicking on non-adjacent colors. Like if I want to move this one fast, I would do yellow and then maybe cyan and then pink. And if the other one is moving quickly, the other one is kind of waddling around. So this greedy approach is kind of decreasing the total distance to the targets. But at the same time, the coordinates are on this four-dimensional grid. That's this great theorem. If you take a number ring and you look at its, you embed it and all its Galois conjugates in Rn, it's a lattice. So this strategy is moving you closer towards the target, and you're on a four-dimensional lattice, so inexorably you're moving towards the goal. And there's only a finite number of positions, and so this wins. Okay, so that's a game. Okay, so what's the next one? Let's see. So this is something that Bill certainly thought about in his paper on rotation distance and triangulations. So over here, this is a triangulation of a 12-sided polygon. And if you like, although this isn't quite relevant here, you can make these elementary moves where you can click on an edge and change the triangulation. So one of the things Bill studied was somehow there's a graph here. The vertices are the set of all triangulations, and then the moves are making this elementary move. And he figured out, basically, at least for large n, the diameter of this graph. But there's another thing you can do, is which you can create something called a freeze pattern. And I wrote this program to try to understand an article of Conway, I guess Conway and maybe Conway and Coxeter. So what you do is you put a row of ones across the top. And then on the next row, you put a bunch of integers. And what the integers are, you count the number of triangles incident to a, is it the triangles or the, yeah, I guess it's the number of triangles. So So here at this yellow vertex, there's five triangles. And then there's a five over here. And then at this vertex, there's a one. And then here there's two. And then here there's four. And then four. And then one. I hope that makes sense, that there's this sequence, this kind of cyclically ordered sequence of numbers you can get. And you can write those numbers in the second row. And then you can get the next row by the property that if you take the four numbers, their determinant should be 1. Like 4 times 3 minus 1 times 11 is 1. Or down here, 7 times 3 is 21 minus 2 times 10 is 1. So this thing is called a freeze pattern. And what's pretty amazing is that well, in general, if you start with integers, who knows what you get. But if you start with the integers which come from these triangulations, the thing eventually goes back to ones. Firstly, you might expect just to get rational numbers, but in fact, you always get ones. I guess this is a special case of what people call the Laurent phenomenon. So the question is, what are the numbers? Like why is some particular number 8? If you look, you can see that there are some 8s in that are highlighted. And the way this works is that the numbers in the freeze pattern, or the positions of the numbers in the freeze pattern, are in one-to-one correspondence with, if you like, the geodesics that join these points. So you should somehow think of this freeze pattern as really occurring somehow out in, if you like, in the de Sitter space. But anyway, you might wonder, like, why is this an 8? What's the interpretation of this number? Turns out there's a neat hyperbolic geometry interpretation, which is kind of implicit in what Conway wrote. But what you do is you think of this triangulation as part of the Fairy tessellation of the hyperbolic plane, famous Fairy tessellation, and you move one of the vertices to infinity, in this case, the green one. And then you just develop the thing out into the hyperbolic plane. So first you see the green triangle, and then this edge hits the cyan one, then the magenta, and then orange. You just develop this thing out, and then you get some rational number. And then the value in the freeze pattern is the denominator of that rational number. So what you can do with this program is you can just kind of click around. You can change the points. And these dots indicate a kind of a, like this green dot indicates this point. This point and this orange one indicates this one. And then you just follow these diagonal lines down. You see where they intersect. It's the number 2. And then you draw the corresponding line here, and you develop the thing in the hyperbolic plane. You get 1/2. So anyway, this is just a demonstration of this theorem that there's this hyperbolic geometry interpretation of freeze patterns. Okay.
Is the depth of your freeze pattern determined by the number of vertices you have?
Yeah, I think it's like you could count, but I mean it's probably like you know n minus 3 or something. Yeah, you can see it's getting longer as it goes. Okay, so that's another one. I can't remember in advance what they are, but okay. So this one, I'll do a demo and explain. This is a dynamical system that starts with a nine-sided polygon with a six-fold symmetry. So it's the polygon in red, and I'll show you the operation. So you start with this polygon, and if you can see, there's this white vertex here that you keep track of. Then you, let's see, so I'll do the demo. The first thing you do is you connect all the shortest diagonals of the polygon. This thing is called the pentagram map. And then you get a smaller polygon inside. The next thing you do is you just erase the outside. Then you turn the thing upside down, and then you rescale it so that it fits. It fits so that the three vertices are kind of it's a little bit hard to see, but the three vertices, there's these three outer vertices which are tangent to this triangle. There's a big triangle here. So I'll do it again. You do this pentagram map, erase the outside, turn it upside down, rescale it. So you do this over and over again, and then you might wonder, you always keep track of a particular vertex, namely this one over here. And so what this demo does is it shows you the effect of doing this many times. So if you stay in this region, this is what the orbits look like. They all, it turns out they all lie on some algebraic curve. So if you do this many, many times, but then you can sort of move around and sort of see what this thing, what it looks like. It always seems to lie on an algebraic curve. So this is a very special case of this thing called the pentagram map, which turns out to be an integrable system for a general polygon. If you consider polygons mod projective transformations, the orbits lie on higher dimensional tori. Well, there's some invariance to the thing. So it has some invariant, and then it's just the level. It's the orbits lie in the level sets of that invariant. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's conjugate to a rotation, but I don't know which rotation. I mean, which rotation depends on what the, what you start. Okay, so that's that one. Oops. Okay. Okay, so this one, I thought I'd show you this. I actually don't know what it does. So what it does, okay, so you can change various parameters. Okay, so what it's doing is it has a bunch of points in the plane. And it computes the minimum spanning tree, a minimum spanning tree for those points. I guess it uses a greedy algorithm. I guess it's usually unique. Okay, so it's got this spanning tree that it's made, and then it rotates every single edge of the tree clockwise at the same rate. So if I was the tree, my arm is rotating, my hand is rotating, my fingers would be rotating. And so it's rotating this thing, and then it's also recomputing the spanning tree at every instant. So I like this thing. I thought it would, I mean, there's some parameter, like it can sort of just rotate rigidly, or it could also, have to remember. So if it's just rotating rigidly, I mean it keeps the, yeah, it keeps all the, oh, it's rescaling it to keep it. I mean, in one version of the program when I did this, the distances gradually got larger, so I rescaled it to stay the same size. I mean, there are several things you can do. You can kind of, it's a kind of a discrete thing. You can kind of rotate a little bit and then push to move the distances out. And so this is what I mean. I can't tell you exactly what this thing is doing. No, it just... What's a tree? It's usually a tree. Anyway, sometimes it looks pretty... I just wanted to make something that was sort of biological looking. I thought this would be... Anyway, I don't know what this thing does as a... It's not quite a well-defined dynamical system because it's hard to say what it is. But yeah, you can speed it up or slow it down. Anyway, but the basic operation is you're taking a minimum spanning tree, and then at every instant you're rotating everything clockwise and then recomputing the spanning tree. So I always wanted to study this, but didn't really know how. Okay. Well, anyway.
If you really rotate, won't the spanning tree just rotate?
Well, you can...
Okay,
so you compute the spanning tree, and then you you incrementally, maybe you rotate each and every edge of the spanning tree. Like there's a central vertex, you rotate all those edges, you come to the next vertex, and then you rotate that edge relative to the edge that's coming up. It's a directed spanning tree starting from some central node. And so at any vertex, there's this incoming edge, and then there's a bunch of outcoming edges. And you take all the outcoming edges, and you rotate them all relative to the incoming one. Now, this thing is going to be spinning around like crazy in some direction, but then you can, correct it so it doesn't do that. There's a more rigid version of it. This one's actually, yeah, somehow this has a more rigid feel to it. Like I said, there are several different rules for this thing. None of which I can remember. But you know, if someone was interested in this, I mean, we could just look at the code and actually and see what it does. I'm trying to balance it so that it doesn't go off the. I mean, yeah, there. So it's like sort of like it's like a rigid tree that's moving, and then it, as soon as the thing connects up to itself, it's like it grabs onto itself and it reconfigures itself like an interval exchange or something. Yeah, probably, sure. I mean, yeah, you know, right. I mean, I didn't try to make it really precise. I mean, you know, although my guess is that these rounding errors are probably not important somehow. Like that if there were no rounding errors, you'd see the same sort of thing. They don't accumulate, in other words. Okay, that's enough of that. Okay, so this one's a little more serious. Although in the end, no more successful. Okay, I have to set this up. So this is a program that Pat Cooper and I wrote. It's called McBilliards. And we were trying to solve the triangular billiards conjecture, which is that there should be a closed billiard path in every triangle. So this window here is the configuration space of triangles. You just parameterize it by two angles, alpha and beta, and everything on this white window is showing you the triangle. And then as you move around, well, in this case, you can see that there's always this blue path is a periodic billiard path, but then when you go into the obtuse side, it disappears. So the main question is, does every obtuse triangle have a periodic billiard path? So this thing is basically a search engine. What you can do is, if you think of a triangle, you can label the three sides, 1, 2, and 3. And then if you have a periodic billiard path, it hits those sides in some order, 1, 2, 3, whatever it is. And any word is tracing some path in the tree of words. And so what this program does is it cuts off the tree at some depth, like 50, and then it does something like a depth-first search through the tree of words, searching for periodic billiard paths. And this looks like an exponential problem because, you know, there's like 2 to the 50 words. But most words, well, what you do is, I'll show you. I have to plot a little more just to, so it found some, like it found this one. Now, if you look in the bottom, if you look at this window here, whenever you do billiards, instead of bouncing the path off the, off the, yeah? Yeah. Yeah, it's right here.
So what is this, the magenta triangle there?
Okay, I'm going to explain that in a minute. But first what I want to explain is that there's this process called unfolding. And if you have a billiard path in a triangle, you can reflect the triangle across the edge, and then continue the billiard path in a straight line. So if you have a periodic billiard path, you'll get some kind of carpet, so to speak, of triangles. And this this window down here is showing you that carpet. Now, as I move around in this magenta region that Andre was asking about, the geometry of the triangle changes and the carpet changes. And when you get to the edge, the billiard path disappears. That what you want is when you unfold this thing, there's some vertices that run along the bottom and some vertices that run along the top. And what you want is all the bottom vertices to be below all the top vertices. Then you'll get a periodic billiard path. And if you think about it, the set of ways that could fail, where a bottom vertex could not be below a top vertex, that's just a finite set depending on the pair of vertices. And so there's some kind of set of algebraic equations which describe, you know, when you really get a periodic billiard path. And so this thing does two things. First, it searches for periodic billiard paths, and then when it finds one that works, it plots the set of triangles up to computer error. It plots a set of triangles which that thing exists. So if you want to solve the triangular billiards conjecture, all you need is a covering of the space of triangles by these regions. So there's a nice graphical representation of these paths. What you do is you take the hexagonal lattice, the one skeleton of the hexagonal tiling of the plane, and you color the edges 1, 2, and 3, depending on whether you're horizontal or left slanting or right slanting. Then if you have a periodic billiard path, you just follow the edges in that order. Now, you'll notice, so this thing here is doing the combinatorics of that path. And it turns out that the path is closed if and only if the billiard orbit is stable. A stable orbit is one where if you move the triangle a little bit, it stays a periodic billiard path. And what it corresponds to in this picture down here is that the first and last triangle that this band hits are always, the last and first edge are parallel. So as this thing shimmies around, the first and last edge parallel, that's a kind of a homological condition which corresponds to this thing being closed. If you go outside, you know, the thing goes like that and it's no longer periodic. So you can go around, well here's a longer one. Let's see. Didn't seem to work. Okay, hold on. So this is a longer one. It corresponds to this word. And then as you move around it, you know, the thing kind of buckles and, you know, but if you move far away, it just goes completely crazy. This is why this algorithm is probably a polynomial algorithm, this search through this exponential tree. It's because you start going down some word and you start drawing this thing and it starts curving like crazy. So then you realize there's no reason to keep searching that branch. You might as well just prune that entire branch. So somehow this algorithm kind of very quickly finds the things where the thing is more or less going straight. I think that's why this thing actually works. It works pretty well. You know, you can search up to things of about length 300. For some kinds of paths, you know, you can get up to about length 1,000. So, in the end, it was kind of a failure. I mean, I guess the thing I ended up showing is that up to 100 degrees, you can get a covering up to 100 degrees. So every triangle with angle less than 100 degrees has a periodic billiard path. But it's an infinite covering. So it turns out that what makes the triangular billiard conjecture hard is that another thing I proved is that for any epsilon, you can find a triangle that's within epsilon of the 30, 60, 90 triangle so that it has no periodic billiard paths of length less than 1 over epsilon. So in other words, you can find triangles that are very close to the innocent 30, 60, 90 triangle, and there's no short periodic billiard path. So if you want to find them, you have to be kind of endlessly inventive. Somehow you have to have this kind of infinite family. So I'm going to see if I can do it. I have to locate the 30, 60, 90 triangle. Hold on. Well, I'm not fine. Well, but if you look at, okay, maybe I won't waste too much time on this. But if you look at this thing, you can see some patterns. Like there's this one, and then there's that one, and then there's that one. So if you look at these three, you can sort of see that they're probably part of an infinite family. So there's some kind of infinite family that covers a neighborhood of the 30, 60, 90 triangle. Okay, so that's McBilliards. The thing does all kinds of things. Those are a few of its windows. It has a memory, anyway.
Do you have a picture of the covering of the triangle you ended up with?
Yes, I do. I have to find it. I was going to show this actually, so I might as well. There you go. You can sort of like over here, all the tiles are indexed. It's an infinite number, so you can't index them all, but there's some infinite families. So there I'm showing you some infinite families.
Can you show us the tiling here, the 30, 60,
90? Yeah, there you go. Yeah, so those are what the unfoldings look like. You can see that there's this infinite, there's really two infinite families that cover it. How's that? Okay. Anyway, so this thing, I made this thing so that someone, this is a kind of a hard theorem to read about because it doesn't really, you know, there's in a sense there's no idea. Just try this and make it efficient. But you can actually use this applet and it gives a sort of an index of everything. It shows maybe the first 20 or so in each of these families to give you a feel for what it is. Okay, so this is, yeah, and, you know, the other thing is it does is it gives you like the rational coordinates of the vertices, so you can sort of reconstruct. I wanted to make something that you could reconstruct the proof. In other words, the actual tiles are some weird algebraic sets or semi-algebraic sets or something. But so what it does is the tiling in this program is by honest rational polygons. Each one is contained provably inside one of these tiles. So somehow it's supposed to be like a kind of a do-it-yourself proof where you could, in principle, reconstruct the whole argument. Okay. So that's that. Okay. Now I have to figure out how to run this. Okay. So this one is the just a simulation of the famous square peg conjecture. So the conjecture is that if you have a closed curve, or if you like a closed polygon, then there's always four points on it which form the vertices of a square. So you can draw the let's see, there are some things you can change, like the maybe at the moment I can't change anything. So there's an example. I guess you can see that there's this one. Maybe I can make this brighter. There, can you see the square? The only problem is if it's not, you know, kind of semi-transparent, you can't see that there are several. So in this particular curve, so this one has two squares. Um, Now, what else is this drawing? These Y's here, if you look, you can also see some circles, although they're not, maybe they're not so clear. Can you see them now? So, well, this is another thing Bill liked to do, is take the cut locus. So this is trying to take something like the cut locus of the polygon, and somehow the squares tend to cluster around the kind of maximal embedded disks. So anyway, this thing, okay, so this square peg conjecture is known for smooth curves and polygons. If you have any smooth curve or polygon, there are 4 points on it which make the vertices of a square. It's just that, so you might think, well, I'm done. I could just take any Jordan curve, like a quasi-circle or something, and approximate it by polygons and apply the theorem and take a limit. The problem is that the squares might shrink down to points. So a better conjecture is this. If the polygon has in radius at least one, say there's some disk inside it that has radius at least one, then there's a square of side at least a quarter. And so I like this because it seems to be a problem you could prove for hexagons and pentagons and so on, maybe get the general idea. So in other words, if it's a fat curve, it has a big square. And if that's true, it implies the whole conjecture. So I wrote this to sort of, I thought maybe I could, you see, there it is. There's one square and there's one disk and they're kind of clustered around each other. But then, you know, let's see, I think, anyway, you can just sort of, it sort of moves around. You can sort of watch and see what it does. It's kind of an ugly color. Anyway, as far as research goes, this is an example of a complete failure. I mean, I'm still thinking about it, but, you know, I mean, people, it's about 100 years old conjecture. Okay. So that's a, okay, let's see. Let's see, hold on. Okay, so, okay, so this thing, going to be a simulation of a dynamical system, which I talked about before. I've talked about it before. So anyway, you have two grids of squares. In one of them, the squares have side length 1, and the other one, they have side length a, where a is some parameter. And then what you do is the system, you take each square in the first grid and you rotate it 90 degrees clockwise. And if you did this 4 times, you'd get back to the identity. But what you do is you rotate 90 degrees in the first square, and then you rotate 90 degrees in the second square grid. And then you go back to the first grid square. So if you like, you have generators alpha and beta, both of order 4, and you look at the word alpha beta to the end. You want to know what happens. So,
Yeah.
So you can't see it so well. One of the grids is kind of the parameter value is 67 over 39. So the green grid is side length 1, and the blue grid has side length. I think again, I can make the colors better. That was a bad choice. There. So there's a. I guess you can see that, right? There's a red grid and a green grid. So this, what's that? Yeah, they both contain the origin. Yeah, they both contain the origin. And they're both parallel to the coordinate axes. So this number, 67 over 39, it has continued fraction expansion 112115. Now, what this has plotted here is this system, if it has a periodic orbit, in fact, there's a whole rectangle of points where it's also periodic. If you're familiar with interval exchanges, if there's a periodic orbit for an interval exchange, there's a whole interval where it's periodic, and this is sort of like a rectangle version. So this thing is plotting within the unit square, it's plotting all the periodic orbits. And then if you look at the pattern, you see one big one like this and then one like this. Let's see. Say it again? Yeah, you have two square grids. And there's a map alpha which turns all the squares in the one grid by 90 degrees clockwise. And then there's a map beta which turns all the squares in the other grid 90 degrees. So alpha and beta both have order 4. So the dynamical system is look at alpha beta, the product alpha beta. And what these pink rectangles are here is they're periodic orbits for alpha and beta. For alpha beta for that element. So you can follow a path down, like here's one, and then there's this vertical one. I'll try to do this. Let's see. Well, I can't remember how to recolor it on the spot. But anyway, there's this vertical one, and then there's this horizontal one sticking off of it. And then there are these two vertical ones sticking off the horizontal one. And then there's one horizontal one sticking off this vertical one. So I'm kind of going in like this, and I have one, and then two, and then one, and then one, and then five. And the pattern is exactly the continued fraction expansion of the number. So it always works. Here's another one, 1, 3, 1, 1, 1, 4, 3. Reset, plot. So there's the 1, and then there's the 1, 2, 3, and then there's the 1, 1, 1, and then 1, 2, 3, 4, and then the bottom 1, 2, 3. You can also pick a point. Maybe I'll stop this. Okay, hold on. I wanted to plot something. So I don't know how to prove that. Maybe I'll just leave it at that. But what I wanted to say is that if you pick one of these points and you look at the orbit, they go very far away in the plane. Somehow the lengths of the orbits are unbounded. So somehow it's one of these things that you can see on the screen, but I don't know how to prove. All right, what was I going to show next? So this one is kind of... this is a similar kind of system. Wrote a lot of programs about this thing called outer billiards. Maybe I'll pick a better shape. So this is a dynamical system where you pick a point and then you draw a tangent line to the shape. And then if you're 2 units away from the shape, you continue 2 units past it. So let me see if I can draw something for you. The problem is I wrote this before my eyes went bad. So let's see.
So I made these tiny, let's see. Ah, okay. Okay, so this big decagon here, if you look at each point, like if you look at the center, it moves across to this center point over here, and then it goes over to here. So in fact, the whole decagon just moves bodily over to here. So this smaller one, which I'll plot in green, maybe it starts over here, and then it goes over to here, and so on. So this is another one of these orbits, and then you can click around, get some kind of sense of what this thing is like. Anyway, that's the, unfortunately I chose bad colors. Can you guys see the white lines? Anyway, that's what it looks like for the pentagon. This is a system that's renormalizable, so it has this self-similar pattern. But maybe I'll show you the seven-gon. Let's see. Yeah, so I don't know why you see that. Anyway, for regular n-gons, this is only understood at all when the root of unity is in a quadratic number field, or so like for seven, it's not. So it's not understood. So like for an 11-gon, nobody knows what these. So this is the so this thing what it lets you do is it lets you take a polygon and then it lets you it lets you draw these pictures and try to study these things. So I'll just end. I'll show you one more, which is also about outer billiards, where this is kind of a half-baked program, but I want to show you one where I really developed it out and made it into a kind of a nice finished product. So the last thing I'll show you, I'll just say a word about what it does. Nope, that's not it. I have to find it. Right, so this central gray square is a particular four-sided quadrilateral, and then these regions here, these different colored regions, they're the domains of constancy for the first return map. So in other words, if I stick to within one of these regions and I bounce around the shape doing the map and I come back, all the points in this region have the same. They return back the same way. This map is a piecewise translation, and the map is translation on all these things to that horizontal strip. Now, if you look at this thing, you get this kind of infinite pattern of shapes. It doesn't quite look periodic, but it has some. It looks kind of vaguely periodic. Okay, so what the dynamics is, you start with a point, and then you go like this across, you reflect in a vertex through the tangent line, then you go up to there, and then there. So in that case, you'd get. Okay, so you have a polygon.
Where's the polygon?
The polygon is the gray. The polygon is the gray piece. So given a point outside the polygon, there's two tangent lines you can draw to the polygon. And you, by convention, you pick the one so that as you, when you walk along that tangent line, the polygon's on your right. So if you're distance d from the polygon, you go out d. That's one step of the dynamical system. You repeat that enough times so that you get back into the strip. So so anyway, this strip, it's some unbounded strip. But the thing I discovered is that actually there's a three-dimensional polyhedron exchange in a compact torus. And this strip embeds in the compact torus as an irrational geodesic. And this three-dimensional compact polyhedron exchange induces the two-dimensional system. So what it does is it converts a two-dimensional unbounded dynamical system into a three-dimensional compact system. And then I don't have time to show you this whole thing, but this thing, it's slicing through a three-dimensional thing. And here's another copy of it. It's slicing through it about three times the rate. It turns out that when you compactify this way and you get this three-dimensional thing, the three-dimensional thing has a renormalization scheme. So anyway, I built this program to investigate this. I'm out of time, but you can sort of move around in three dimensions and really look at what this thing is like. So this program sort of, it gives a computer-assisted proof of that this three-dimensional compactification is renormalizable, and it does it with exact calculations in a certain number field. There's no round-off error and things like that. So it's sort of a program. It's sort of a program which, it's like a document that's a computer-assisted proof. And also, all these programs, maybe the last thing I'll advertise is they always have question boxes. So if you are trying to use one of these things and you click on the question boxes, you can't read the text, but if you could, it would tell you what that thing does. So I had this idea that instead of writing papers, I could write these kind of computer-assisted proofs where the proof resides in the document, and you can just operate the program and then see that it works. I guess I was going to show you more, but that's it. Yeah, they all are. I mean, usually I'll write a paper and then have a link. So yeah, you could download them from my website. Yeah. I mean, often they don't transport well. Even though Java is supposed to be easy to transport, it frequently happens that people, well, not frequently because people don't use them frequently, but on the occasion when someone has tried, it will usually require some kind of Skype conversation to actually get that thing to run. Something.
Yeah. Are these programs furthermore open source? Like, can you download the source code?
Yeah, sure. When I post them, you can. Okay. Yeah, it's all in the directory. Yeah. And also, they're also kind of self-documented in a sense. Like, when you push these question boxes, it will tell you how to operate them, and sometimes it'll give some information about the code. I guess, like where to find things in the different files. Stuff.
Yeah. I have a ding bad question. I have the same problem you do on my Mac screen, the dancing Adobe Reader icons.
Yeah.
What's the recommended solution to that, anybody? Are you supposed to just ditch Adobe or what?
Ditch Adobe.
Okay. Yeah, well.
If I read an ordinary proof, I usually learn something. And I imagine that if I operate a computer program, I would learn a different thing. So how would that compare to a to a proof that I'm used to in terms of the way it's...
Well, I don't know what you're used to. I mean, like, what I mean is, like, when I read a paper, you know, I don't know. I mean, I'll try to work out a special case of what they're saying, say. You know, try some instance of their theorem and see if I can see what's going on in that particular case. So you might say that this program gives you, like, 1,000 instances. You can try all these things. And then it's true that, I mean, so I don't know. I mean, you might learn more. Like, you might actually learn what's going on somehow. Get some kind of direct visual, you know, impression. I mean, I don't know. Some of it, on the other hand, I'd say probably these proofs tend to be somewhat low on ideas, in a sense. Like, they're, you know, I mean, just honestly, there may be more ideas packed into a traditional paper. Whereas here, there might be a few main ideas, like, let's compactify and then look for a renormalization scheme. But then after that, it's just the question of implementing it. Like, well, this piece goes over here. And so, I mean, I don't know. I mean, like, some of this stuff, like this outer billiard stuff, I ended up writing a book about it. And it would take you, you know, a year or something to read the book, but, you know, in like an afternoon or something, you could learn almost everything you needed to know. I mean, there's all this structure that you can see. I don't know. I mean, I guess it gives you some kind of visual appreciation for geometric structure, which maybe in a paper you'd get too, but you might have to just kind of reconstruct it, you know, more slowly in your own mind. Yes. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm not a big fan of computer-aided proofs, but sometimes it's all I can do, solve the problem, I guess. Yeah, that's all.
So, who would estimate the ratio of bugs to working stuff is in a paper versus a program?
I would say 1,000 to 1. I mean, I bet if you looked in the traditional literature and like highlighted everything that was wrong, I mean, in red, it would be mostly red. I mean, you know, someone says they have some scheme and it's defined. Yeah, I once was trying to read this paper and they said, yeah, they had this spectral sequence and then, you know, this, we're not going to, they said, well, we're not going to redo it because we did it in the other paper and this one's the same except all the arrows are reversed on every third level. I mean, you know, one thing about the computer is that it does force you to be exactly right in a sense. Like, you know, you might have some sum and, you know, you can see it up to 10 decimal places and so you've got a pretty good idea that it's right. I mean, you know, yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, you know, I think with computer programs what happens is initially there's tons of bugs. But then if you can get past that and it starts working, it tends to have this kind of self-reinforcing effect. It, like, yeah, I don't know. So I'd say...
Do you think are there any language improves, better languages that make it easier to do what you try to do?
Yeah, I mean, probably. I mean, I like Java because it, you know, it has the kind of this inbuilt nice graphic system, and also in theory, it's portable. I mean, I guess. You know, I don't know. I mean, Nathan here uses, you know, Python, for example, and many other things, and Sage, and so on. I mean, there's lots of, yeah, there's some things like, and some of the things I've done, I've written my own programs that will do, you know, calculations, say, with polynomials over a number field, and Sage might do it automatically. So there are various things that would be better for different things, or maybe C would be faster for some things. I just like, some of it's just inertia. But also Java does have a lot of, you know, kind of everything together. Yes.